You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
And we're live.
Okay. And we're recording.
I'm recording. Okay, that's
sorry.
Funny. So long and the short of it is we did the section of Contributions to Philosophy, the event that we're about to read a couple nights ago, I guess.
Yeah.
And for some reason it didn't, well, I know why, it didn't record. So we're literally going to redo it. I mean, we're going to reread the sections that we read and I guess try to hit the major points that we hit last time.
Yeah.
I think it's important that we don't get caught up in like trying to exactly repeat ourselves because there's no way we can.
Yes.
But I think the text will probably elicit various ideas that were elicited before. But this is essentially a redo.
Yeah. Right?
Which is okay. But the problem is we rarely do well when it's a redo.
That is a problem.
Meaning,
I'm kind of hoping we'll get a little further.
Yeah. Okay.
I know.
I'm just saying we get bogged down in trying to.
Recreate,
but I don't think we should. I think we should just, you know,
yeah.
This podcast is about experiencing Heidegger fresh and new and having the ideas come to us. I mean, I'm sure some...
I did make some notes, actually.
Okay, that'd be great. I'd love to hear those. Yeah, so we're in the middle of section 62, right?
Page 100,
which is called Machination, the section 62. Imagination, and I think we're just going to dive right in, right?
Let's do it.
Okay, go ahead.
Machination as the essential occurrence of beingness provides a first intimation of the truth of being itself. We know little enough of machination, despite its dominating the history of being in the previous Western philosophy from Plato to Nietzsche. Excuse me. It seems to be a law of machination. The ground of this law is still unfathomed, that the more prescriptively machination unfolds, thus in the medieval period and in the modern era, all the more obstinately and machinationally does it conceal itself as such. In the Middle Ages, behind the Ordo and the Analogia Antis, in modernity, behind objectivity as the basic form of actuality and thus of beingness.
Machination is the essential occurrence of beingness, provides a first intimation of the truth of being itself. So that machination is essentially... or is currently the essential occurrence of beingness, gives us a first insight into the truth of being itself. I think this is all basically, as he kind of points out, relevant to the first beginning and the emergence of Western philosophy from Plato to Nietzsche, that machination is the essential occurrence of beingness through representation, through objectivity, and the various metaphysical forms that Western philosophy has imprinted on us and the way that determines our relationship with beingness, all of which gives us an insight into the truth of being, meaning this format of philosophy and culture and representation that has been going on for over 2,000 years actually is also an intimation of what bang is, how bang works. And then he makes the point of the law of machination is that the more prescriptively it unfolds, meaning prescriptively would imply the more it unfolds as a prescription, as a mandate, as a bettering, right? Mm-hmm. As a curative, as it did in the medieval and the modern era, all the more obstinately and machinationally does it conceal itself. So the more it operates on us, the more it conceals itself. In the Middle Ages, it concealed itself behind the Ordo, and that's like the order of the world, like the cosmic order, like God is up here, and then there's the heavens, and then there's the earth, and then there's hell, and you know, the whole hierarchy of powers in the Middle Ages. And then the analogia entis, which remember last time,
yeah,
we looked, is essentially the theory that God and humans are related only through analogy, that there's kind of no interplay between the divine and the mortal, that they only interact through analogy. And we asked about that analogia and analog, right?
Yeah, the analog camera.
And we looked up analog,
and it has the same root.
It does have the same root. And the interesting thing was that, for instance, an analog clock was called analog to begin with, or these types of mechanisms were called analog because they analogize what they're trying to measure. So, for instance, the clock with the sweeping hands of an analog clock analogize the movement of the sun. So that's where we get the word analog, which is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, machination conceals itself in the contemporary era as objectivity. So go ahead.
Mm-hmm. To this first law of machination, a second is joined. The more decisively machination conceals itself in this way, all the more does it press toward the predominance of that which seems completely opposed to its essence and yet is of its essence, i.e. toward lived experience. Cf. Everything on lived experience in quote, the resonating.
Yeah. And so we have lived experience here, and this phrase, which we've seen before, and we're going to hear more of it in just a little bit and kind of hear more about what it is and why it's such an important concept for Heidegger. But he here links machination to lived experience, and the more there is machination, the more does there come to be the predominance of something that seems completely opposed mm-hmm. to the essence of machination and yet is actually of its essence, and that is lived experience. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I'll say about lived experience here, because we are going to go on to read more about it, is that I think we've talked about lived experience on the podcast and the kind of predominance of the... in a sense, the ideology of lived experience in liberal thinking, mm-hmm. certainly in the arts and elsewhere. And I think it's essentially that one's lived experience gives one authority over what one has experienced, over the truth of what one has experienced. And lived experience becomes... a kind of subjective dominion and also tends to be about validating lived experience, confirming lived experience, reinforcing one's lived experience, right? I mean, mm-hmm. yeah. What do you have to say about the lived experience idea? I mean,
oh yeah,
you totally. Talked about it relative to therapy, kind of.
Yeah. I can't remember what I said.
See, that's the thing. You're caught trying to remember what you said.
But
so don't try to remember what you said.
Lived experience and therapy. What did I say?
I mean, again, I think that the underlying premise, or in a sense, again, the ideology of lived experience is that the experiences that one has had, which are representable to one, which have presence for one, which are ascribed being, are considered the ones that are important, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. for one's development, growth and development, right? Mm-hmm. For yeah. one's personal psychology, for one's internal emotional and cognitive dynamics. Mm-hmm. And there's it excluded from that ideology is the idea that things that one has not had lived experience mm-hmm. of, excluded from is the idea that the things one hasn't had lived experience of, is that they're irrelevant.
Right. I see what you're getting towards, but we talk about that later.
Okay, great.
I wrote about it later.
Then let's move on.
My notes.
Let's move on. I think the most important thing here is just that imagination and lived experience are conjoined and they kind of feed each other, and mm-hmm. we need to continue to explore what each one means and why they're so important to Heidegger. Go ahead.
And so a third law fits in. The more lived experience is unconditionally prescriptive for correctness and truth, and thereby for actuality and constancy, all the more hopeless does it become that from here a knowledge of machination as such could be acquired.
Yeah, so I think just some very important words here in terms of understanding what he means by lived experience. And lived experience becomes an unconditional prescriptive for correctness and truth. And it becomes, as well, for actuality, what is actual and what is constant, mm. meaning what exists through time. So if one has lived experience, then one can prescribe what is correct. One can prescribe what is true. One can prescribe what is actual. One can prescribe what is constant. And the more one does those things, the less one has knowledge of how machination is working mm. on us. Go ahead. Mm.
The more hopeless this unveiling, the more unquestioned our beings, and the more decisive becomes the antipathy toward the questionworthiness of being.
Yeah, so the more hopeless it is that machination would be revealed, the more beings are unquestioned. They're beyond question because they're based in the prescriptive constancy and correctness of lived experience. The more decisive becomes the antipathy toward the questionworthiness of being. So literally people become antipathetic, or they become hostile toward actually asking questions about Bang, and the idea that we should ask questions about what is Bang, what's the Bang of what's going on and such like that. Because why would they do that? Because lived experience provides them with authority and prescriptive power, and the questionworthiness of Bang is actually an offense to that power. Very liberal, mm-hmm. but go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's making me think of maybe this is what we talk about later, but like the lived experience, like with intrusive thoughts.
Maybe this is what we talked about later?
Yeah.
You mean earlier?
Earlier. Okay. Later in the section.
Okay, yeah,
great. Earlier in time, later in the section. The lived experience as intrusive thoughts, because it's like this sort of, it takes... I mean, I define intrusive thoughts as basically a thought I don't want to have or I don't like. And it takes some lived experience, since it's a thought that's had, kind of adds weight and value perhaps to those, to the existing thoughts. I think that's what we talked about later, uh-huh. is yeah. the existing thoughts. Where those thoughts themselves, what they're actually coming from, we've talked about as sort of potential liberal anxieties, movie scripts, things we see in the news, like these words that are coming in are not necessarily a feeling I'm having. They're more, in a way, I would say scripts or fears. So the lived experience gives a weight, an actuality, a constancy to those thoughts when, in a way, they don't need to have any of that.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think that really points at the the something that I think is important to understand about lived experience, which is that there's something that is apparently both sort of, you know, makes the subjective experience objective and predominant and prescriptive, but at the same time, there's something external and objective in itself about the lived experience, in the sense that you're right, that information, machination, narration, mm-hmm. right,
mm-hmm.
that comes to you from the outside because you have a lived experience of it,
mm-hmm.
you kind of habitually or instinctually mm-hmm. claim it as your own or as you
mm-hmm.
or as true or as very, as in very internal, almost as yourself.
Yes.
Because the addiction to the idea of lived experience is acquisitive.
Mm-hmm.
And it invades your instincts and your internal energetical resonances and takes all this stuff that's happening outside you that other people are saying, and it turns it into your internals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that happens outside of volition or beyond choice. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of the machine of lived experience and the way it takes the objective and makes it subjective and takes the subjective and makes it objective, and you lose your place. You lose, like, all of a sudden everything that's very external, again, machination, narration, information, affect you as if they are literally you when they're not. So it makes separation really, really hard. This also to me echoes the idea of projection.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going right? to say that.
Yes. You were going to say that? Very well. Yeah. Very good. Yeah. The fifth sameness category, anonymity, labeling, and projection, you know, that because
of the things that make up identity.
Yeah, that's right. And they make identity different than self in a way. And projection is exactly that. So machination, information, narration, projection, where other people's thoughts, other people's information, other people's concerns, other people's prescriptions, other people's emphases, other people's anxieties are projected onto you. And because you're so much about the objective presence and actuality of your lived experience, all of their stuff becomes your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't separate them. And now you're really under their control, not necessarily their conscious control, but you're living their life as well.
Yeah. And it's like, is it just like through the act of, let's say, reading an article or watching a movie, and then
sure.
it just kind of becomes
you.
Becomes part of you because of the value of the lived experience.
It's important to point out that it doesn't need to be that way.
Right, right.
But it is because machination foments lived experience, and lived experience conceals machination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like he's saying, the inverse relationship, right? So almost it's like the more lived experience, the less we're able to see machination.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So the more you're able to see machination, the more you're able to, in a way, detach it from
that's right.
the lived experience.
That's right.
Yeah.
You want to keep reading?
Yeah. Where are we? Machination itself?
Yeah.
Machination itself withdraws, and thus being itself withdraws, since machination is the essential occurrence of being.
Yeah, this little paragraph stumped us the first time we read it, right?
Yeah.
And I think machination itself withdraws. Machination withdraws as lived experience predominates, and thus bang also withdraws, since machination, and then this is just where we blew mm-hmm. our minds, is the essential occurrence of bang. What? And the important thing about this little sentence is that what Heidegger wants to point out is that Well, we talk about machination as if it's some kind of artificial, out of this world, objective, non-bangy, in a sense, existential parasite. It is itself the essential occurrence of bang. There is bang, and everything that's occurring is bang. And so don't think that there's something that's not bang, and that it's almost like a non-natural, supernatural, removed, again, parasitical force. And if we get away from it, we can finally get to bang. That's not it at all. Bang, it is the essential occurrence of bang. Everything that's happening is the essential occurrence of bang, and machination is happening. So yeah, that's
yeah, and kind of also that if we can recognize machination when it's happening, then that gets us closer to bang, because we
That's right. Especially if we can experience or recognize the occurrence of machination.
Yes.
If we see, that's exactly right. Like, we just don't see machination, but if we can see it and be aware of it and recognize it through the fog of our lived experience addiction,
yeah,
then we can see bang at work. So,
yeah.
So that's why we study machination, so we can understand how bang is working there. That's right.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Wow, I like it better the second time. I guess we have to read everything twice.
I was going to say, I think the second time is great, but the first time was great too. And
yes, of course.
I'm worried that we're going to miss something, but let's see. We're not done yet. We're not through yet.
Yet, what if out of all this, which is to every appearance merely adverse and deprivational, there arose a quite different insight into the essence of bang, and bang itself unveiled itself as refusal, or even brought itself to resonate.
Yeah. So what I've been saying is, as it seemed kind of adverse and deprivational, as if I've been talking about something that is sapping the internal and essential force of existence out by imagination, but it's not. What if out of all of this there arose a quite different insight into the essence of bang? In other words, he follows the prior paragraph with this, saying that, look, out of this story of imagination, this description of imagination and lived experience, we can get an insight into the essence of bang, and bang itself is unveiling itself as refusal, right? Refusal to be machinated, refusal to lived experience. And bang is resonating in that refusal. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. If machination and lived experience are named together, that indicates an essential belonging of the two to each other, but at the same moment conceals an equally essential non-simultaneity within the time of the history of bang. Machination is the early, but for a long while to come, still concealed, distorted essence of the beingness of beings. Yet even when machination takes definite forms, as in modernity, and shows itself in the popular interpretation of beings, it is not recognized as such, and certainly is not grasped. On the contrary, the expansion and entrenchment of its distorted essence are carried out in such a way that machination explicitly draws back behind that which seems to be its extreme opposite, and yet which completely and utterly remains under its domination, and that is lived experience.
Yeah, beautiful paragraph.
Yeah.
Imagination and lived experience are named together. They are, he's saying they're very correlated, they belong to each other, but they are not simultaneous. Machination comes first, right? It is the early distorted essence of the being of being, the beingness of beings. Yet, even as it takes definite forms, as in the modern age, and shows itself in the popular interpretation of beings, so and comes to be seen in how beings are interpreted in the popular sense by a large number of people, in a kind of formulaic mass sense. It's not recognized as such, is not grasped. On the contrary, the expansion and entrenchment of its distorted essence is carried out in such a way that imagination draws back behind and goes back and sits behind lived experience as a kind of causative engine of lived experience. And lived experience kind of does the work and is the face of the machinational force. Yeah. And by the way, in that non-simultaneity, in that relationship, in that man behind the woman, or that woman behind the man, or that, you know, that machination behind lived experience, mm-hmm. in that there is bang. Bang isn't that is that's the that's like a core mm-hmm. core aspect of the bang of Dasein and human mm-hmm. beings. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The belonging of the two to each other can be grasped only through a return to their most disparate non-simultaneity and through a dispelling of the semblance of their extreme oppositionality. If thoughtful meditation, as questioning of the truth of being and only as this, achieves knowledge of such belonging, then at the same time the basic thrust of the history of the first beginning, the history of Western metaphysics, is already grasped out of a knowledge of the other beginning. Machination and lived experience constitute, as a formula, the more original version of the one expressing the guiding question of Western thought, beingness, being, and thinking as representational grasping.
Yeah. Machination and lived experience belong to each other. If thoughtful meditation is going to achieve knowledge of such belonging together, then at the same time, the basic thrust of the history of the first beginning is already grasped out of knowledge of the other beginning. So as thoughtful meditation kind of unravels this relationship between machination and lived experience, we start to step out of the first beginning mm-hmm. via the other beginning and have a knowledge of the history of the truth of bang and the story of beingness as it's unfolded through time. Machination and lived experience constitute, as a formula, the more original version of the one expressing the guiding question of Western thought, beingness and thinking. So machination and lived experience are kind of aligned with this idea of beingness and thinking. So thinking as representational grasping, in a sense, I think aligns with lived experience, and machination is being, I see beingness as being. So what he's saying is that through the history of Western philosophy and through the first beginning, and what has evolved into where we are now in Western thought is that beingness has being. So that is at the core of what machination is, and thinking is representational grasping. That is at the core of what lived experience is. Hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I don't quite get the beingness has being.
So beingness is, I would say, is essentially synonymous with essence or represented being. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And so machination takes represented being mm-hmm. and considers it as having being.
Mm-hmm. I see.
In a sense, it's being abandoned by being. Mm-hmm. It takes being abandoned by being as being being. Mm-hmm. But being abandoned by being is not being. It's a different kind of being, or maybe it's being, but it's definitely something that needs to be considered separate from just being and analyzed as such. And we've kind of talked about liberalism as being the cultural trend or the cognitive trend, you know, the developed in a sense, a culmination of the first beginning, mm-hmm. as being an ideology that assigns truth to being that's abandoned by being, mm-hmm. or assigns truth to beingness,
yeah.
to generalities, mm-hmm. to essences, Right. Think of just generalities. That's the best way to think about it. You know, talking about woman.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Talking about black people. Talking about white people. Talking about my favorite liberal generality, the world. Right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So these kind of generalities are beingness, and they apparently supposedly have being.
Yeah.
But they don't.
Yeah.
But the aggressive, recurrent, systematized, institutionalized, politicized repetition of the generality, the general beingness that is talked about as if it has being, is what machination is.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, all we're talking about is beingness and not about beings.
Right.
Things that actually are.
Right.
And then thinking as representational. So what are we doing when we're thinking?
Yeah.
We're just trying to grasp representations. Heidegger would say there's a deeper thinking, a more true thinking.
Or analogy. Sorry.
What's that?
Or the analogy.
Yeah, so lived experience is thinking as representational grasping. It's just grasping the way things are represented. And that smells of liberalism too. I mean, liberals have come to be, as we've seen recently, hyper-obsessed with the way things are represented. You're supposed to represent things in the right way. You're supposed to use the right words. It's a representational matrix of correct representation.
Yeah.
Because it's about one's lived experience, and representations are real and have real ramifications, and so we need to represent correctly. And apparently trying to figure out the correct representations of things is what's called thinking under liberalism.
Yeah, that's true.
But in fact, it's not thinking.
Yeah.
It's just juggling representations.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Should we keep going?
Yeah.
62. The disguising of the abandonment by being through machination and lived experience. A disguising which belongs to that abandonment itself.
Yeah, that basically just says what I just said. Yeah.
One. The belonging of machination and lived experience to each other.
Yep.
Two. Their common root. Three, to what extent they complete the disguising of the abandonment by being. Four, why Nietzsche's recognition of nihilism could not be grasped. Five, once the abandonment by being is recognized, what does it reveal about being itself? The origin of the abandonment by being. Six, which paths are necessary in order to experience the abandonment by being as plight. Seven, to what extent does that require the transition to the overcoming, Dasein? Eight, why for this transition does Hölderlin's poetry first become futural and thereby historical?
Yeah, so running through these really quickly, we've said belonging, the machination and lived experience belong together. They have a common root. The common root is the guiding question of Western thought. Inherent in concepts of beingness and thinking as representational grasping. They complete the disguising of the abandonment by being. So together they cover up the fact that being has been abandoned by being. They prevent the recognition of nihilism. They prevent the grasping of Nietzsche's recognition of nihilism. So Nietzsche's recognition of nihilism is essentially let's call it a description of the world in which machination and lived experience have come together to control how we think and how we behave. They are based on nothing, and that's the nihil in nihilism. And so this emptiness or this abandoned by being or this representation as reality is Nietzsche's nihilism, and it could not be grasped because, as Heidegger says, the machination is concealed by the emphasis of lived experience. I think this is a rhetorical question. Once the abandonment by being is recognized, what does it reveal about Bang itself? How does Bang operate in this abandonment by being? What is the origin of the abandonment by being? Which paths are necessary in order to experience the abandonment by being as plight? To what extent does that require the transition to the overcoming? Meaning, to what extent does taking these paths and experiencing the abandonment being as plight require that we transition into Dasein, which again is different than just being human. Dasein is I would call it a more intentional and Bang engaged way of existing. And why for this transition does Hölderlin's poetry become futural and thereby historical? So why don't you you want to repeat your...
No, I don't, actually. I was just like...
Last time, in the unrecorded sessions.
Yeah. I was just kind of like, I like all this, except I'm not crazy about like Hölderlin being like the cherry on top, because it feels a little like a... I don't know. It's like... I can't think of a good analogy, but it just feels a little like a... Oh, this amazing artist is the best, and that's really the answer, as opposed to what the answer is. But I think as we discussed it, what did we discuss about Hölderlin? We were just like, there's actually a lot of concepts such as like the gods seem to actually be pulled from Hölderlin's poetry.
Yeah.
So it seems that there might actually be a lot of influence, but we also looked and could not find any English translations, at least on Kindle or Audible. And you said that you've read both the German and English, and that the German is much better. So the English translation wouldn't help anyway. So we also, thought we should probably be reading Hölderlin as well, but we don't really have access to it.
Yeah, exactly. And, I think Hölderlin, Heidegger revered Hölderlin and taught him all his life. And so Heidegger dropping Hölderlin here to the German and to the philosophical audience has a lot of resonance and meaning. Like it means something to them. Like, of course,
right.
We see like Hölderlin was a prophet, a seer who established a lot of the ideas and dissonances and templates of interpretation that we are exploring here through you, Heidegger. And Heidegger obviously is nodding to Hölderlin as he does.
Yeah, he might be like giving a little credit or something.
Yeah, I just think that, and Hölderlin Heidegger considered Hölderlin as discovering and grounding a lot of his ideas about being and the abandonment by the flight of the gods and the turning of history and the world we live in and what our sort of existential human Dasein-ish obligations are or predicament is. Hölderlin, in a sense, was his Bible, shall we say, his root text, which is again something I don't think we can quite appreciate, because yes, Hölderlin is very non-read in the English world. As I said, I think his German is hard to translate into English as I would say, like the example, like it was Emily Dickinson, who I think is so, her English is so specific and the words are so interrelated with each other and the etymologies and the very subtle use of different words next to each other that in the translation, it just disappears. I mean, it's like Homer, it's like, you can't read Homer in translation. It's just never going to happen, On that note, I've heard that Shakespeare translated into German is often called better than Shakespeare.
Really?
I've heard people say that.
Interesting.
And I've never read Shakespeare in German, but I can almost imagine it. But that's partly because of where Shakespeare lay in the history of English. But I won't. He was at this cross point between Anglo-Saxon English, which was very Germanic, and contemporary English. And I'm sure that the German translation of Shakespeare takes him and almost makes him sound almost more Anglo-Saxon than he would to us, and that gets really fun and juicy in terms of feeling the etymological resonance of Shakespeare. Anyhow, that's our thing on Hodulin. Why don't we go ahead and read this 63, which is a really good little section on lived experience, because I think it encapsulates what lived experience is about.
Also, I misspoke. There is some Hodulin on Kindle. So
in English.
In English, it seems, yes. So we'll have to read some. Into it, Okay. 63, lived experience. To relate beings as the represented to oneself as the relational center, and thus to incorporate them into life. Why the human being is life, animal rationale, ratio, representation.
Exclamation point.
Exclamation point. What can count as actually being is only what is or can be the object of a lived experience. What presses forth in the realm of lived experience, what humans can bring to themselves and before themselves.
Yeah. Do you
recall? I do have notes on this one.
Yeah, why don't you give us the notes? That'd be interesting to hear.
Yeah, so what I wrote down is, well, do you want to go through it first?
No, okay. Give me your notes.
What I wrote down is, anxiety is thoughts and feelings able to represent, say, what's happening, press on us more than those that we are not having. So this connects to what we were saying earlier in the episode. So being hyper concerned with what experiencing, with what one is experiencing, as opposed to not concerned with what one is not experiencing. And that's due to machination.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. So lived experience is about relating beings to oneself as the relational center. Mm-hmm. And by that incorporation or that interrelation, incorporating them into life. They come to life by being represented to one's self as the relational center. Mm-hmm. In other words, I mean, you can always think that in the context of anxiety. If you take a being and you represent it as what it represents, which again is not what it is, it's just how it is represented. And you represent it to yourself, and you are the relational center, that then brings it to life. Mm-hmm. So it's, in the context of anxiety, it's literally that if something is represented to you, mm-hmm. it comes to life.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's, in a sense, if you have a thought and it has a representational force, then it's real. It comes to life because you're the relational center.
Yeah.
And now it needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be of concern.
Mm-hmm.
So you're literally handing out life to what's trying to destroy you.
Mm-hmm.
What counts as actually being in this regime of lived experience is only what is or can be the object of a lived experience. What presses forth in the realm of lived experience, what humans can bring to themselves and before themselves. So, you know, in a sense, it sets up this trap where what is only that which you are experiencing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And what you're not experiencing is not. Mm-hmm. It doesn't exist. And so you become crushed and controlled by that which you bring into yourself via your lived experience, and that which comes to exist only by relating to you. Mm-hmm. And that's a trap, because there are a lot of things you're not experiencing, a lot of things you can't represent, a lot of things that can't be brought mm-hmm. before you. But those are irrelevant, aren't they?
Yeah.
And I think in talking about therapy, you know, it's a major tacit assumption of therapy that one's lived experiences are what one is there to discuss, and that they are causative and regulatory and predominant in the establishment of what one is. Mm-hmm. But that, again, is not necessarily the case. Mm-hmm. That's an assumption. That's an ideology. Mm-hmm. Which is why therapy is a failure, and why therapy is bad for you. Mm-hmm. Because therapy enforces the idea that you are the product of your lived experience, mm-hmm. and only what you've had lived experience of has being, and in its being, it has control over you and had relevance for you, and nothing else really matters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right?
Totally. Yeah. I have more notes from.
Yeah, please.
I think
love
it was
them.
All around this section.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah, that was very well said.
Give us some more notes.
Okay. Relatability comes from lived experience.
Yes.
So then you need it more. And this was in the context of, like, I think I brought up this mom yoga group that I'm part of, and this sort of.
That's
feeling
right.
that, like, and also just sort of group therapy vibes.
Yes.
That's like this feeling. And we had actually a lovely guest here recently, and she would often kind of reference like her friends and their feelings. And it's, I feel like there's just this ethic that if someone else is having the same issue that I'm have, that validates me. And that somehow should make me feel better, which in reality, I feel like for me personally, it doesn't actually make me feel better. And it causes this need to be constantly looking outwards to other people's narratives, to find narratives that seem to resonate, which seem to give me words to my supposed lived experience. And it is quite a mess. But anyways, what I wrote down is relatability comes from lived experience and causes you to need it more. So unrelatable cause anxiety because unexplicable, unexplainable, unlikable.
Yes.
Relatability of lived experience.
Yes.
And yeah. Then I have the support group therapy affirmations.
Yeah, great. I'm so glad you wrote all that down. That's really well said. And
sorry, can I read my last thing?
Yeah, please, please, yeah.
Representation words as way to build community as mystical. Feel better hearing the words said by others.
That's right. So we live in the age of the tyranny of relatability. I mean, anybody who's on social media, anybody who's tried to succeed on social media, reporting for a friend here, you know, you discover that relatability is the currency of the internet. Maybe relatability is the currency of society. I'm not sure. But relatability becomes a mandate, an ethic. And that, as you say, has these resonances and tentacles into this idea that what we talked about, the idea of like I'm just so relieved to hear that someone is having the same experience. We hear that all the time. I'm so relieved to hear someone say what I was thinking. And so people become hunters and scroungers and spiders, like on the internet, like scrubbing the internet, scrubbing the world for people who think and speak and have the same experiences as them, because this is somehow relieving. This is somehow this assuages their pain and their isolation. And the thing about relatability and the thing about echoes and people repeating your words back to you is that relatability and the symmetry and similarity and homogeneity of experience among peoples and the community of all that makes things that you can't relate to all the stranger, all the scarier, all the less relatable. And so the world becomes this dichotomy of the relatable and the unrelatable. I can't relate to that. I don't relate to that. Oh, that I really relate to. That I really relate to. And this causes anxiety. Not only the fixation and the obsession with relating and being related to and hearing yourself echoed in others, but that causes anxiety in itself, but also then the barbarians at the gate, the outsiders, the unrelatable masses, the unrelatable ideas become even scarier because you can't absorb them into your lived experience. You can't understand them. You can't relate to them. Mm-hmm. And we talked a little bit about how you and I feel a little bit, and there are lots of people like this, we feel the opposite, I would say, mm-hmm. in a sense. We do not feel relieved when someone, I don't think we're necessarily on the hunt for hearing our thoughts repeated mm-hmm. to us, or the hunt for the relatable. I think we're a little more just on the hunt for the new, mm-hmm. the interesting, the engaging, the thoughtful. Maybe it's not what we've ever thought. Yeah, the insightful, the non-thought, the non-repeated, the non-echoing, mm-hmm. the non-relatable, which may be just as much an addiction as the thing, looking for the relatable. But I think one thing I remember saying last time was that, oh God, I'm so glad to hear someone say that. I thought I was crazy.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And it's funny because in my view, it's just the opposite. Mm-hmm. Like if you have a thought and somebody expresses it back to you, taking that as a sign that you're not crazy is the opposite of what you should be doing, because right. it's actually probably the sign that you are crazy. In other words, is being the only person with a thought a sign that you're crazy or a sign that you're sane? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is the idea that everybody has the same thought mean that everybody's therefore sane? Or does it mean everything's there for crazy? And I mean, in a sense, both those phrases, we don't know what they mean. It doesn't matter. But mm-hmm. the compulsion and the sense of relief one has in being like, oh, I thought I was crazy, but wow, finally somebody's said the same thing as me. Mm-hmm. It's funny to me that that's taken as a sign that one is not crazy when I would kind of take it as a sign that one is. Relatability does that, and the emphasis of relatability, the emphasis of non-lived experience. Is there something I missed?
Yeah, no, that's really interesting.
And then, therapy, again, a failed social experiment that's destroying so many lives and so many nations and so many possible good things, so much creativity, so much contentment, so much peace, so much nature. Therapy, becomes a game of relatability mm-hmm. because what you're supposed to do is not only are you supposed to relate to the therapist, and the therapist is supposed to relate to you, and you're both relating, and that's wonderful, but you're supposed to relate to yourself. Mm. Right? Like you're supposed to build a self you can relate to. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to construct relatability narratives with yourself, with your past, with your representations. You kind of are. Therapy has become this stupid game of building a relatability doll of yourself, which gets you nowhere, other than you're relating to a doll.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Or other than
representation.
Yeah, exactly. You've invented a narrative that now you can sort of relate to, as if that's getting anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you know, again, all coming from lived experience and the idea that the only thing that has being is what presses itself forth and mm-hmm. brings itself to you and becomes the object of your lived experience,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like what you were saying about, I'm so glad I'm not crazy when someone else has that same idea, and how it could be the opposite. That was really, really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that also cuts to the heart of like one's relationship with a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something that's really creepy about therapists, I think, is that, and therapists are total creeps, is that you know, you're supposed to get affirmed by them.
Mm-hmm.
They are supposed to have some kind of authority. They're supposed to have some kind of, they justify your thoughts. They validate your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you you're not alone. Mm-hmm. They essentially hold your hand as you sew this relatability doll.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means this relatability doll is not actually an image of you. It's an image of you, mm-hmm, as the therapist, as a person who's a therapist whose hand is being, mm-hmm, held by a therapist,
mm-hmm,
and moved by a therapist. Mm-hmm. And therapists do a lot of reinforcing certain addictions, attachments,
mm-hmm,
and self-acknowledgments and self-affirmations,
mm-hmm,
that give one the idea that shaping one's personality,
mm-hmm,
is a project worth, is a safe project, mm-hmm, shall we say.
Yeah. Yeah. And is an important project.
Yes.
Say, that critical. It can save you.
That's
as
right.
Opposed to this idea that it could just take you further down the
therapy hole.
The therapy hole. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's,
I mean, in a sense, like, you know, if Heidegger is talking about Trump, I don't know why I said that. I can't even think. Was I thinking about him? No, I don't know if I was thinking about him. If lived experience is thinking as representational grasping,
uh-huh,
right, then therapy is definitely,
yeah,
the encouragement of thought as representational grasping. Like therapy could just be called, let's come up with a new representation of what we are.
Mm-hmm.
That's what therapy is.
Mm-hmm.
So therapy reinforces lived experience, reinforces imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I want to say is, I think there is a type of thinking, or there's a thing called thinking, that is different than representational grasping. Mm-hmm. That therapy has stopped encouraging,
mm-hmm,
maybe never did.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure we can know the history of therapy. I think we can only kind of understand therapy as it's being practiced,
yeah,
currently.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there's a type of thought that therapy prevents.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think therapy is really grounded in the establishment of self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And self-esteem is a horrible idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredibly ungracious, ungrateful, unforgiving, power-hungry, self-absorbed, anxiety-riddled, tendentious, and fragile idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To think about to to strive for self-esteem is a great human tragedy. Mm-hmm. Because that concern itself is a delusion and a distraction. Mm-hmm. People say, "Oh, so I'm not supposed to have self-esteem? What, I'm supposed to just think I'm a piece of shit?" Thinking you're a piece of shit is not the the opposite of self-esteem. Mm-hmm. It's actually the same thing. But the dogma of lived experience and self-esteem and therapy has taken these two things and made them opposites.
Yeah.
Which again is classic liberalism to cover up its schemes. It uses words.
Yeah. Talk more about that. That's really interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot in... Yeah, there's a lot of like you said, like the therapist is like, you're okay or you're not okay, I guess, or, you know, the self-esteem, like, I guess it's like, is implying that you need self-esteem is allow self-esteem to not be there with you.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
And I think somewhere in the heart of, I don't know, maybe all anxieties is just this fear that like, if the self-esteem, like if you don't have self-esteem, what's going to happen? Are you going to die?
Yeah,
basically, right? I mean, at the end,
such a degraded sense of your own self-worth, you won't even move.
Right.
But, yeah.
Right. And, I feel like in the end, like if you take it all to like sort of where it's going, it's just, I think we've talked about before, it's a fear of death. Mm. So just that like this in a way, like if I don't have self-esteem or self-confidence or I don't believe in myself or I don't have a valuable lived experience, like like you said, the opposite of that is... in a way death, but actually death is those things.
Yeah.
So, or anxiety or terror or something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's this like, cause I mean, that's just something for me is I very much want to hear that from my therapist that I'm okay, that there's nothing wrong with me, that having intrusive thoughts is normal, that it doesn't really mean anything. But in a way that's needing to hear that from, or wanting to hear that from someone is not, I don't know, it's not the solution.
Well, yeah. And I mean, you know, I think it's, you know, if one needs to hear that, one needs to hear that. I don't think one needs to say, well, you don't need to hear that.
Yeah.
I think that the problem comes along when think therapy is obviously and constitutionally incapable of helping someone understand why they need that, mm-hmm. and what there might be outside that need, mm-hmm. and how the development of what lies outside that need could be a transformative and safe experience.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
That therapy cannot facilitate its own undoing,
mm-hmm.
because it is ideological liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. it's not about saying to someone, oh, you don't need self-esteem. It's about saying, well, where does that need come from? How did that need emerge? Why is that need there? Do we need that need? What is that need? Who are we? How can we be outside that need? What is that need for? Is it really for what it says it is for? Mm-hmm. Like, let's really investigate that need, which in a sense is thinking.
Mm. Yeah.
Building self-esteem is representational grasping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Trying to find out the deep embedded meanings and causes of that need is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
which therapy denigrates and prevents. And just even like it's almost like I don't even mean to disparage therapists themselves. Like, I don't mean to denigrate college professors themselves, though I might be willing to do both of those things. It's that the structure in which they both operate has become so liberally ideologized, so machinated, so prescribed, that the possibilities of what should be an open relationship or a non-relationship have been destroyed. Mm-hmm. Therapy has become a relationship. Mm-hmm. Education has become a relationship. And in a sense, they've both become political actions.
Mm-hmm.
And all either of those professions should be doing, and I'd add yoga teachers to this as well, is trying to destroy that relationship so that something actual can happen, so that thinking can happen. But that would be very economically self-destructive. And that is definitely not something liberals are ready to do.
Yeah.
Because liberals love the money. Or shall we say, liberals love the destruction and bastardization of thought in the service of money. That's what I was saying. I love money too, but not enough to destroy thought for it.
And I think there's also something in the way that the sort of the machination, the structures, the embeddedness of it into like our core ideas of who we are and what reality is it's so there that we can't even recognize it.
Yeah.
So, and that's what Heidegger is so good at doing, is starting to like pull it apart. And I mean, I guess I'm thinking about this, you know, this deep state, this doge, this sort of idea that there is like all these really deep internal set things that we don't even know are operating, but have a lot of control and power. And
the NGOs.
And the NGOs. And I mean, obviously that's just one. I'm sure there are many layers, but that's just one example. But it's a, it feels like, it just feels like it's so structured or thought and how, and how things are that it's.
I mean, I think therapists, college professors, yoga teachers, they are the bureaucracy of of the brain. And I think like what Heidegger is saying about the way the more machination comes to be prescriptive for lived experience, the more concealed it is, unless the one can understand how it's operating and controlling everything. Again, written 100 years ago, you couldn't find a better description of the current American bureaucracy. You couldn't find a better prescription of current American therapy, current American education, the professoriate, the current American spiritual guidance industry. You know, the more it just defines reality and takes over people's minds, the less you can see that it's a massive deep state bureaucracy of mental control. And the less anything ever gets really established in there, because it's being abandoned by being, and there's really no thinking going on. It's just representational grasping. Which is why I think, you know, we sit here so excited about Doge, so excited about the dismantling of bureaucracy, because we want freedom, we want thought, we want change, we want a government that is more transparent, more responsive, more limber, more active,
mm-hmm.
And again, more responsive to who's been elected.
Dynamic, yeah.
Yeah, more dynamic. Yep, exactly. And it's why there are now protests all over this country by people saying they want the bureaucracy there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why do they want the bureaucracy there? Because the bureaucracy is their brain.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want it gone. It's their brain. It's their livelihood. It's their maximal democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's their definition of the world. It's their definition of the good. It's their ideal society. It's their comfort zone. It's their defense against anxiety. It's their identity.
Mm-hmm.
It's their whole identity. Mm-hmm. That's why people are burning Teslas, because Musk, in the service of the electorate, is destroying their identity and their comfort and their meaning and the bureaucracy of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taking it apart because, let's remember, it was built and is being paid for on the dollar of millions of people who don't want it to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Who don't want it to be the bureaucracy of their brain. This is the nature of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It has been established that there's a majority of people who don't want it to be the bureaucracy of their brain. And, you know, so those who want it to be the bureaucracy of their brain are accusing those who don't want it to be the bureaucracy of their brain of being anti-democratic and being fascist and blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is a lie.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you know, people want to be free. They voted for freedom. They want freedom. Mm-hmm. Give them freedom. They get freedom. They deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
They won it. They won the freedom,
mm-hmm.
right? They won the freedom of therapy not controlling how they think.
Mm-hmm.
College professors not controlling what they think.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. You're a big pet peeve. You know, Harvard today, the Trump administration gave Harvard a bunch of demands.
Right.
Did you read about it?
No,
about
I didn't. This? No. Well, I guess at some point, yeah.
I mean, Trump
they did
the,
it.
The administration has been giving. The administration has essentially been playing the activist investor role
mm-hmm.
with colleges. You know, there used to just be investors. Or activist angel is another word. You know, you used to just give money to charities.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple decades ago, these activist angels came around. And they would, big rich guys, and they would say, oh yeah, sure, I'll give $10 billion to the Red Cross if X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So now the Trump administration is playing activist angel with mm-hmm. these colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Harvard gets $9 billion a year from mm-hmm. the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So Trump administration.
That's my pet peeve. I'm like,
I know that's why I said.
That's what
I said.
A school
and
that
so the Trump
can't
administration.
Even afford to go to.
I know the Trump administration gave them a bunch of demands, and Harvard said, "Kiss my crimson ass."
Oh, they said no.
Yes.
Oh wait, I thought they said yes.
No, Columbia did.
Oh shit! Wow.
But Columbia, you know, whatever. Columbia said yes for $800 million. Harvard wants $9 billion. From
wow.
Now, I think what Harvard's going to do is they're just going to try to take the whole thing to court. So I think they said no, because now they're going to try to take it to court and say Trump doesn't have the right to do that to us. Give us our money.
Wow.
Which is just hilarious. You know,
wow.
Like, wow. The entitlement of these people, man.
Yeah.
So I can't remember why I brought that up, but I know it's a thing with you, but you know, again, the professoriate of Harvard,
mm-hmm.
the richest university in the world, probably,
mm-hmm.
the most entitled, arrogant, liberal, really shithole that you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
right?
Oh, yeah,
thinks
wire
that it deserves,
tax dollar.
Yeah,
dollar.
I mean, it thinks it deserves forward. $9 billion. And it so deserves it that if an elected president were to put some conditions on that money, they're going to like sue him and take him to court.
Wow.
That's how deeply they deserve everything regardless of what the voters think. See, that's the important thing.
Right.
Screw the vote. Like the apparently people who are out to save democracy
Right.
Say, screw the voters. We need that $9 billion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
We deserve that $9 billion.
Yeah.
And that is therapy professoriate in a nutshell, meaning they define reality.
Mm-hmm.
They define what is. Their lived experience matters far more than, say, a democratically elected government.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, the democratically elected government is thought.
Mm.
And Harvard's sense of entitlement is representational grasping, is machination. They're the, I mean, Harvard is the epicenter of machination. It's the epicenter of the whole thing. It's the epicenter of liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the epicenter of cultural corruption.
Yeah.
Hopefully, I mean, it won't happen, but the most beautiful thing is if it were to be closed down.
Yeah.
It needs to be closed down.
Yeah.
It's a blot. It's a blot on civilization.
Yeah.
Fuck Harvard. That's what I'm going to call this episode. Fuck Harvard.
Wow, maybe someone will finally, like, listen.
Yeah,
to our podcast if you title it that. I think... I feel like there's something that I want to still relate it back to in terms of where I'm not sure, like just something about how this structured endemic or whatever core, this way of thinking like, never mind. I don't know.
Just... Yeah, okay. Well, then I guess that's it.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to end.
Cool.
All right. Night. Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.